You are listening to a podcast from The National.
Arsene Wenger aggrieved after another offside goal and a questionable penalty decision goes against his Arsenal team in yet another defeat at the Etihad Stadium as Pep Guardiola's Manchester City march imperiously on. Antonio Conte's gamble on omitting David Luiz pays off as Chelsea beat Manchester United. And after the high of beating Real Madrid, Spurs have to grind out 3 points against bottom club Crystal Palace. And finally, Everton shows some resolve in a come-from-behind win against Watford. All that and much more on another edition of the National's Extra Time podcast. Joining me in the studio this week is our sports editor, Graham Cagill. Graham, welcome back, mate.
Good to be back.
Well, to kick things off, we're going to go straight to Richard Jolly, who's joining us on the line from England. Now, Richard is our Premier League correspondent, and he covered the game on Sunday at the Etihad Stadium for the National. A game that City won pretty comfortably 3-1, a little bit of controversy throughout the game, but it was a result that took Pep Guardiola's team 8 points clear. Richard, how are you?
Good, thanks. Good, Steve, you?
Excellent. Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad at all. Now, Richard, you obviously covered the game for us on Sunday. Arsenal manager Arsene Wenger was very unhappy after the game at the awarding of two of City's goals, accusing Raheem Sterling, a man he tried to get in a swap deal,
or at least
going
to ground
too easily, something
window.
He said he was particularly good at, and also very peeved at the third goal where David Silva looked a mile offside. But taking his grievances on board, especially with the third goal, do you think City were worthy winners?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think when you analyse a game, you can sometimes go through decision by decision and try and add up scores according to what you think the referee should have done. And in that instance, I actually did think it was a penalty for Monreal on Sterling, but I thought Silva was offside for the third goal. But if you take the game as a whole, look at the number of chances, the quality of chances, the way the two teams played, I felt that City were better than Arsenal and were definitely two goals better than Arsenal. And in the first half in particular, City got themselves into some fantastic positions and then just didn't quite get the final ball right. But it was one of those where if they had got the final ball right, the player in the middle would have pretty much had an open goal. There were two or three of those where they were trying to score the perfect goal and came close but for that final ball. But I thought Arsenal really weren't particularly good. They were a bit confused in terms of team selection. I thought the omission of Alexander Lacazette was interesting because it showed that Arsene Wenger is reluctant to field Lacazette, Ozil and Sanchez all together in the toughest games. He's done it in lesser games. I thought Francis Coquelin playing at centre-back was an odd choice. It was partly to keep the system going in the absence of specialist defenders, but I didn't think that worked out. And so I think Arsenal started off with what was probably quite a negative formation, ended up with what was quite an ultra-positive group of players on the pitch, but didn't really have that happy medium in between. Whereas that's what City have got at the moment. They are actually a very attacking team in many ways, but they've also got a very good balance. And I think that's one of the reasons why they're going as well as they are this season, because that was something that Pep Guardiola struggled to get last season. I think he's got it this season.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there, Richard. And if we take the first goal, for example, now it was Kevin De Bruyne's initial shot that was parried out to the left. And I think this is where you see the best of the Belgian playmaker, because he sprinted to a wide position to give Leroy Sané an easy option. It's just the way City kept recycling the ball. Now, he played a 1-2, hit a fantastic shot to open the scoring. And that, for me, was both the best of De Bruyne and the best of City in that one move there.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you look at De Bruyne, he's several things in one, because he's a creator, first and foremost, but he can also score goals. And he is a very technical player, but he never stops running as well. So like you say, when he has that first shot and it's saved, he doesn't just stand there and put his head in his hands or just remain somewhere where it's easy for him to mark. He does what City players have to do under Guardiola, which is move and create an angle so that whenever the next player gets the ball, he's got someone he can find, and ideally two or three people he can find quite easily. And he's moved over towards that kind of inside left position which is where he scores from. And it's also notable that he plays the 1-2 with Fernandinho, who is the holding midfielder, but is firstly a very energetic holding midfielder, and secondly a very good passer, but thirdly also someone who can get into those positions to play those little passes with players like David Silva and De Bruyne, and he can be on their wavelength. I mean, it was actually, I thought, quite unusual for Fernandinho to get the assist, but he's involved in quite a lot of goals further back in the move, and that's part of the reason with City. It's not just we've got three or four really good attacking players. It's the fact that there's a lot of players who can contribute at various parts of the goal. De Bruyne has been the headline act, rightly so. He's been outstanding this season. But they do have that number of quality players who are all comfortable on the ball, who can all create an angle, who will all be on the move constantly. And that's, I think, one of the things opposition find toughest to play against, because in itself, some of City's passes are actually comparatively normal passes. But it's the movement, it's the angles, it's the number of players they've got, and it's the relentlessness of it.
Okay, Richard, so it's 11 Premier League games played, 10 wins, 1 draw, 8 points clear of their nearest rivals. They've already beaten Chelsea and Arsenal in the league. They've secured their place in the knockout phase of the Champions League and the League Cup. Now, everyone is getting excited about the potential of what Pep Guardiola's side can achieve this season. So I guess my question is, how do you stop them?
I think the first thing to say is that everyone has a bit of a blip sooner or later, and everyone has a bit of an off day. I think what City's opponents will look at, firstly, they'll hope that maybe they get City immediately after a tough Champions League game. Maybe they'll hope they'll get them when somebody is injured. And I think City are playing very, very well, but it'll be interesting to see how they played without Fernandinho, because there isn't a like-for-like replacement for him. Be interesting to see how they played without De Bruyne, because he's just been so good. And you can go through the team and say the same with several different things. I mean, I think Fabian Delph's been a revelation at left back, but if he was out as well as Mendy, would left back be a weak spot? At the moment, with Vincent Kompany injured, City are only one injury away from Mangala playing at centre back, and he was poor against Wolves the other week. In goal, I think Edison has been a real upgrade on Claudio Bravo, but again, they are one injury away from Claudio Bravo playing. In terms of any individual match, there are always reasons why even a dramatically superior team can lose a game. If you think of finishing, for example, and I mean, City got their final ball wrong too often yesterday. They played Wolves in the League Cup a couple of weeks ago, and they didn't score in 120 minutes against a Wolves team that had made 9 changes. Then if you factor in maybe the possibility of a moment of brilliance from an opponent, an individual error from a City player, of which there were quite a few last season, rather fewer this season, maybe, to go back to Arsene Wenger's complaints, if a decision goes against City. So there are all reasons to say that sooner or later, City will not carry on at this remarkable pace. I think the problem for everyone else is not so much can they lose a game, can they drop points, because the answer to that is obviously yes, but will they drop enough points, and will they lose enough games for everyone else to come back into the reckoning? Because City are 8 points clear. Now, teams have made up an 8-point deficit in much shorter time. United and Tottenham only need to make up 8 points over the next 81 available. But you still need City to lose those points somewhere along the line. I think probably the toughest places, logically, will be the away games at the rest of the top six. I mean, to me, the most important win of City's season was that 1-0 win away at Chelsea, because to win away there, I thought, was huge. Even though, I mean, beating Liverpool 5-0 at home was obviously a statement result, and winning away at Napoli in the Champions League was obviously a statement result. So in terms of those big away games, I think the Manchester Derby in about a month's time will be one where everyone will be looking at that to see what Manchester United can do there. Can Jose Mourinho get a tactical plan to frustrate Guardiola? You would imagine United might well have some players back by then. It would be a big question, I think, if Paul Pogba is fit by then. But I still think that someone else needs to produce that level of consistency, because City look like a team who could get 90 points this season.
Definitely.
So if you're going to stop them, you need to get 90 points, whoever you are. That's whether you're Manchester United, whether you're Tottenham, whether you're Chelsea. Chelsea obviously got 93 last season. I don't think they'll get as many. I would have said that United would have been the one with the most chance of getting up towards that 90 mark. I think that defeat at Huddersfield was probably a really big blow to them, because that was points being dropped where they probably didn't anticipate it. And United have really got to demonstrate the level of consistency that City have been doing, go on a run of 7 or 8 straight wins to really reframe their season and reshape things in that respect. So yes, City can be stopped, but it won't be easy.
It's interesting you bring up the Manchester derby in December. Now, December's looking a very congested fixture list, not just for City, for all the teams, but in the space of 13 days, they've got West Ham at home, Swansea away, Spurs at home, and obviously Manchester United, throwing a Champions League trip to Shakhtar Donetsk. Now, like you mentioned, the teams chasing them, the Uniteds, the Spurs, the Chelseas, they'll not want that gap to get any bigger, because the United game and the Spurs game, those are matches where those two teams are going to have to really do some damage on City to try and rein them in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's interesting you mentioned the Champions League, because all three teams are currently top of their group and in good positions. But at the same time, you look at those fixtures towards the end. I'm sure City would like to have won their group before they go to Donetsk, so they could leave some people behind. I think United will have won their group, so that will give them a bit more freedom in terms of what they do in the Champions League. Tottenham, again, they'll want to win the group. But in terms of December, I mean, Pep Guardiola is very aware that City had a difficult December last year. I mean, City's form in August and September last season was very similar to August and September this season. December was when it started to go wrong. December's been a difficult month for them in the past. That sheer backlog of games all coming close together. Then if you factor in that some of them are big games, then if you put in a couple of injuries as well. Guardiola was already talking yesterday about the importance of going to Leicester, because Leicester was where City produced arguably their worst performance last season. They were 3-0 down in about 20 minutes then, and that's their next fixture. And City do have a squad that everyone admires, obviously, but it's not actually the biggest in the world. They would have liked to have got another defender in the summer transfer window, and that was even before Benjamin Mendy got ruled out for a long time and Vincent Kompany got sidelined again. So when you have all of those games in such close succession, there is the potential for things to go wrong quite quickly and for one bad result to spiral into another.
OK, Richard, well, listen, thanks very much for joining us, mate. Much appreciated.
OK, no problem.
Well, Richard raised some interesting points there, Gray, about the teams in pursuit of City at the top of the table, one of them being Chelsea. Now, Antonio Conte took a huge gamble on leaving out David Luiz, not only from his starting lineup, but from the entire squad against Manchester United. It was one that paid off, as Chelsea were never really threatened in the 1-0 win at Stamford Bridge. But this story isn't over, is it? I mean, the next time Chelsea lose, the media, they're going to hone in on the fact that Luiz now looks to be ostracised from the team. Despite the result, all is clearly not well at Chelsea. How is this going to develop? How is this going to play out for Conte?
Well, everything we know about Chelsea, normally this ends in acrimony and the manager getting his P45 and leaving possibly mid-season. But I don't think it's at that level yet. I always quite admire managers who will go toe-to-toe with a player.
Well, he's already done it with Costa, hasn't he? And no doubt David Luiz is a massive character in that Chelsea dressing room. As you could see from the pictures yesterday, very popular among the staff, among the players. And Conte has taken him head on and butted heads. And he's won round one, definitely.
Oh, absolutely. As you said, the key thing is going to be the moment a result goes against them and he's not on the pitch, or if there's a mistake in the defence, or whoever's in playing instead of Luiz makes an error, that's going to be thrown back in his face. Because the crucial thing is, he gambled yesterday by making the stand and they won. It's fine as long as you're winning. Like, I always remember the last stand of Ruud Gullit at Newcastle when he dropped Shearer and Ferguson, which ultimately in hindsight was absolute lunacy. But he obviously felt he had to make a stand, being destabilised by Shearer. If they'd won the game, who knows what might have happened there. But of course, the moment they lost, he was on a hiding to nothing and he was done. And
well, that's the thing. Most managers make these decisions from a position of strength. And really, with Conte coming off the back of the 3-0 thrashing at Roma in midweek, a game in which David Luiz made very obvious his disapproval of being substituted in that game, he wasn't really in a position of strength to do that. That's what makes the move all that more gutsy to do it. But clearly Conte has laid down a marker. He's the boss and they're going to do things his way.
I think that probably will be his undoing ultimately. He is his own man, but it might well be a case of that he's probably planning on trying to see it out to the end of the season and see where they go from there, because he was quite vocal in the summer. He wasn't happy with the transfer policies and the recruitment, and it's clear there was trouble in Paradise then. Because if we look back in hindsight last season, there was a lot of things that went in their favour. They didn't really have any injuries. The only real problem they did have was of their own making, his falling out of Costa. And he managed to make that work until the end of the season, well enough for them to be champions. But it's hard to know. It just seems to go from day to day. He's certainly a combustible character. And I've got a feeling if Abramovich does get involved, I don't think he's going to swallow it down if he's not afraid to clash with some big-name players. So it certainly makes it interesting. And the fact that they're already 8 points behind in the championship doesn't really help either in that case. And I've got a feeling he and a lot of other managers are already probably trying to prepare themselves for the angle of, we're not really losing, we're just being beaten by something really special this season. So that might well be helping him in that line.
Well, yeah, it's very hard to argue against that. But some more positive matters, I guess. I mean, Cesar Azpilicueta and Alvaro Morata are developing an almost telepathic understanding. That was Azpilicueta's fifth assist of the season. Now, if you look back to last season, the defender with the most assists across the season, I forget who he is now, but I know it was five, and he's already on that number. That's three times he's supplied his compatriot for goals. But for Morata, it was a very timely reminder of his qualities after a relative period of quiet after such a blistering start to his Chelsea career.
I think obviously a lot was made of comparing him to Lukaku on the pitch, because Lukaku was the guy who Chelsea that was their first choice. And I think in many ways that's been their bonus. And sort of, and again, as we were talking about how Conte's taken risks, obviously fed up with Costa, moved him out. And Costa's it's not really fair to compare him, because they are very different forwards. But as he said, Morata has been, the way he's adjusted to the Premier League so quickly, because it's very rare to come in immediately and sort of click. And especially when you think he started the season with scoring goals without Hazard in the team.
Yeah.
Because Chelsea are a much better side.
I thought Hazard was superb yesterday.
And that's going to be the thing I think that will kick them on, is the fact that they're beginning to gel. And the weird thing is, like, probably the most other important player in their team is Kante. And you can sort of miss him. Like, I don't think they'd lost that game to Palace a few weeks ago. In that mould, and sort of they do feel a little bit more brittle. I think that highlights just how sometimes you can have the perfect storm. Leicester had it, Chelsea had it, and they didn't really have many injuries last season, and they didn't have Europe to sort of get in the way. And like the Champions League's proving a bit of a distraction for them so far. Like they're probably still going to go through, and that's going to be probably what's going to help Conte. Is Roma was disappointing, but there was parts of the game, particularly the defending, that was worrying. But it's not a crisis just yet.
Okay. Yeah, I take on board what you mean about Kante as well. He thought that's where Chelsea won the game on Sunday. The United midfield was just totally dominated by Kante, by Fabregas, Bakayoko running off the likes of Herrera and Matic. But it's not all doom and gloom at Chelsea. Like you say, all the teams are being blown away by the fact that Manchester City just look so dominant at the moment. But if we go to the other end of the table now, Gray, Everton. Now, given how poorly they have performed this season, their come-from-behind win against Watford, for me, might just rank as the outstanding performance of the weekend. 2-0 down early in the second half, they staged a roaring fight back to come back to 3-2 and had a little bit of fortune that does tend to desert teams that are struggling in Tom Cleverley not doing what he should do in the 101st minute and burying a penalty of the game. It was a fantastic win for them. We've spoken about them at length over previous podcasts. We couldn't see where the spark was going to come from to ignite their season. Could this be it, this result?
I think that's always the thing that we all love about football, where we all get into it, is for these moments of They did look dead and buried after 66 minutes of that game. Like Watford had been excellent away from home largely this season. Even the one game they had lost against Chelsea, they're in a position to win it with 20 minutes to go. And so they're 2-0 up. You're thinking sort of Everton, the morale's pretty low. It's gone. They got a hell of a lot of luck with Watford's first goal, with the reserve goalkeeper who'd come on for Aurelio Gomez having a moment of madness and charging out to a ball he should never have gone for, and it gifted them the goal back, and it lifted the crowd and it lifted them. But from then on, it was just craziness. But what was impressive was Everton didn't really ever give up, and Unsworth or whoever takes over have got to sort of take heart from that. That's sort of that element of belief. And obviously, they had a little bit of luck with Tom Cleverley's penalty at the end of the game, but in fairness, sometimes teams are due that, and sort of I think Ronald Koeman probably wishes he'd had some of that.
Yeah, definitely. You mentioned David Unsworth. What does this result do for his prospects of landing the manager's job full-time?
I don't really think, from everything I've seen so far, nothing about that screamed full-time manager. He just seems like a bloke who's really happy to be there.
Yeah.
Sort of like, give it a couple of weeks and I'll have David Moyes' expression on his face, I'm sure. That sort of natural exterior. But I think he acknowledged himself, like, the biggest thing he built up after was character. He wasn't claiming it some great victory, classic off the tactics board, go 2-0 down, hope the reserve goalkeeper chucks a wobbly and get back in it that way. I don't think it was one of those, but I think...
The perfect plan.
It's like one of those... I'm always keen on sort of seeing young managers being given a chance and such, but I'm not sure if this is a job for him anyway right now, because whoever comes in, there's a lot wrong with that Everton squad, full stop. And it's going to need a lot of work doing it. It probably does need a little bit more experience or someone who's a little bit more happier with money, because I doubt whoever comes in will have quite the funds that Koeman blew in the summer.
No, definitely not. He blew a massive chunk of their budget, didn't he? Well, from one manager to another. Now, Marco Silva has earned rave reviews, plaudits galore for the job he has done at Watford this season. But they've now suffered 3 defeats on the spin. Their next game is against West Ham after the international break. How important has that fixture suddenly become? Not suggesting his position is perilous or anything of the such, but, you know, he's, like you said, their road form has been absolutely superb. But all of a sudden, it's looking like a very tough league again for Watford.
It's going to be an interesting one because they've got injuries. As well as losing the game, injuries came out of that. And they've still got Troy Deeney suspended. So the West Ham game will have a lot of pressure. And with all the rumours that are going on about Slaven Bilic, it is a very real chance they might be facing a revitalised West Ham under a new manager and pumped up, which could make it tricky. I think it just highlights what's funny about the Premier League is how short-term everything is. Like 3 weeks ago, they had their come-from-behind win against Arsenal and everyone was on a massive high. And I think... when they were leading 2-1 against Chelsea, they could have gone third in the table for at least a short while. And here we are now. I think they're down to 12th as a consequence of this little run. And so it didn't tell the full story. They played very well at Chelsea, and a bit of naiveness in front of goal and a bit of an inexperience in the defence caught them out. Stoke City, I think they got known as what's in the industry, Stoked.
Stoked. Yeah.
And Everton, as we just spoke about, they imploded. But what would be interesting to see is, like, I think teams will have looked at what Stoke did to Watford. Sort of, certainly, Watford have got a run of games coming up against teams in the mid-table. And so if you sit back against them and sort of make them ask the questions, that's why they're being so good away from home, because they have more space to go for against Stoke. They really struggle to open up the Stoke back line. And lots of it is, as I think we've seen a lot of results this weekend, there was lots of narrow 1-0s. It is difficult if teams defend against you because the quality of defence is in the Premier League. But that was an element that really did catch out Watford. But the one thing I think, a lesson possibly for everyone to take from that game, what we were talking about with Tom Cleverley missing the penalty, was Troy Deeney kind of lost a plot, which was disappointing as Watford's captain against Stoke City. He got wound up by the time-wasting tactics and got involved with Joe Allen and deservedly got a free match ban retrospectively after the game. Troy's Watford's penalty taker. And now he has missed penalties for Watford before, but you'd have fancied him much more than a bloke who's only scored 1 goal in 2 seasons stepping up, as what happened with Cleverley. Because he stepped up to do it, and there's other players who'd probably expected to take it ahead of him. But it does kind of just show that in the 92nd minute, sometimes there are consequences long term for losing your rank.
Definitely. Now, we touched on David Unsworth's job prospects. One man who is not, or whose prospects seem to be just going on an upwards trajectory week after week, is Sean Dyche. Now, another victory on the road, this time at Southampton, up to 7th, level on points with Arsenal and Liverpool. The job he's done at the smallest club in the Premier League history, operating on a budget a tenth of the size directly above them, surely it's only a matter of time now before he decides that he has reached his zenith with Burnley and it's time for him to test his credentials at a bigger club.
I think he probably is very hungry to have a go at something bigger, but I think he's aware of sort of seeing how other managers are being burned by going to the wrong club and just going for the sake of it. Like we saw with when Sam Allardyce really made his name in the 2000s at Bolton and then went up to Newcastle, which was always going to be probably a bad idea given how unstable they were, change of owners and such. And he only lasted 5 or 6 months. And the problem is at Burnley, there's no expectation. At his first job at Watford, there was no expectation. And he's done brilliantly at all these clubs so far and what he's done. But then obviously there are still question marks which chairman at the bigger clubs would be wondering, what would he do with a budget?
Yeah.
Because it's all very well working well, when you've got 20 million to blow on a striker, when you've got 30 million, you know, when you've got bigger egos. Because everyone at Burnley, like, I think that's, they've got a real togetherness about them. And I like how he deals with them when they win, but also when they lose. Like,
yeah, it's very grounded, isn't it? It's very level-headed.
I was always very impressed with how he handled himself and the squad after they lost to Lincoln City in the FA Cup fifth round last year. That was about, everyone kind of was like going mad on Lincoln thing. And he easily, you know, could see some managers having histrionics. It was a very embarrassing result. But he handled it with great dignity, praised Lincoln, didn't sort of forget anything they'd achieved during the season. It was like, right, we'll just get on with this.
Yeah,
you know,
on to the next game.
And, you know, it was very easy at the end of the season, sort of like, you know, to just sort of like relax on the beach for 3 months. Staying up in the Premier League was more than anyone expected, and to do it so comfortably. But then to sort of come back, and if you think last season, it's almost like a sort of polar opposite. Like, they've kind of kept the home form pretty good still, but yeah, if you think
their away form,
their away form was awful last season, and they've turned that around and made themselves tough to beat. And sort of like, you know, there's a real credit to him that he hasn't just sort of sat on his laurels. There's no sort of attitude of, yeah, you know, this is what we're staying up here to do.
And doing largely what they did last season. Whoever comes up against Burnley is always going to have the lion's share of possession. You know, there's been no new blueprint drawn up in terms of the way they play. They're just, like we said earlier, with Everton, I guess, getting the rub of the green in terms of getting goals as well and getting late goals as well, which is really helping them.
Oh, no, completely. And you think, like, and he's made changes. He made good changes as well. Like Andre Gray left in the summer. He was important for him last season. He's gone to Watford. Made good changes, bringing in Chris Wood, sort of like, yeah, as you said earlier, sort of bringing in strikers and stuff can be difficult, sort of making, or, you know, making the right picks or sort of, you know, knowing what to do can be a sort of, it's a tough challenge, but he's sort of been rewarded. He's shown good judgment and I definitely think he deserves an opportunity. And I personally think he would be a good fit for Everton, I think, for the job, yeah, they've got to do, because I don't think there's any real bad eggs in that squad. It doesn't seem like there's any real egos or anything like that as such. It's just more a bit unbalanced and something, nothing about good management and so on. You think he took it, he inherited the side of mid-table in the championship, that I think they'd had a run in the Premier League about four or five seasons earlier but had threatened nothing like that, yeah, since. And it's not just the fact that he took them up once, they got relegated, but he consolidated, brought them up again. Yeah, it's just like he's done an excellent job and he definitely does deserve a chance at a bigger club.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Okay, let's move on now to Tottenham. Now, after the almost otherworldly performance against the European champions Real Madrid at Wembley on Wednesday, it was always going to be hard for them to replicate that kind of game, that kind of intensity, that kind of atmosphere against the Premier League's bottom club, Crystal Palace. They rode their luck at times. If Wilfred Zaha had shown a little bit more composure, they could have been chasing that game. But like most good sides, they find a way to win ugly. They find a way to win when they're not playing particularly well. A very good result. Obviously not quite on the level as a 3-0 win over Real Madrid, but it's going to be important to Spurs in the long run, 3 points like that.
No, absolutely. As you said, it's kind of like it's the same at the top of the bottom. It's like, it's on your good days, you're going to win, but it's what you do on your bad days or your average days that count. Like at the bottom, any point you can burgle in those cases, it might be crucial in the season. But at the top, like we've already seen Tottenham Spurs have had a little bit of trouble, you know, replicating the White Hart Lane form at Wembley.
Yeah.
Sort of like,
I mean, if you take on what Burnley did to them this season, yeah, that game could quite easily have ended in another disappointing result for Spurs.
And the same with the Swansea game as well, sort of like riding their luck a little bit at the back and sort of Roy Hodgson's obviously taking a bit of a hospital ball pass and sort of taking on the job. But the one thing he can do, sort of in a more relaxed environment, when he's not tempted by having to play Wayne Rooney at the number 10 slot repeatedly at England, is organise a team. And you can see he's already had a good influence on Palace in that regard.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's just how much work has been, is it too much to do already and such. But as he said, like, and what's more impressive, this wasn't Spurs at full strength either, because obviously Pochettino made some changes. But and obviously losing Dele Alli as well for the game was about, and because Dele Alli is the kind of player who sort of makes those runs that can sort of very hard for the defenders to pick up, that could have made Palace's life a little bit harder. But as you said, they found a way to do it. And sort of we're in a situation where, as we already mentioned, City are disappearing into the tracks. So the crucial thing, you can't afford to lose many more points, especially to teams who are going to be in the bottom end of the table, because it's going to be hard enough anyway. If they've got any hopes of catching City, you're already kind of looking at the fact you're not being able to drop that many more points than we're already doing.
Yeah, this is what we were discussing with Richard on the phone, wasn't it? The fact that Manchester City have got a difficult run of fixtures in December, where they play Manchester United and Spurs, all in the space of 6 days, I think, off the top of my head. Now, both them teams can't afford to not reach those games in any worse position than they are now.
Mm.
And in those games, they, you know, Spurs need United to take points off of City, and likewise, United need Spurs to do some damage against Manchester City. So it's very much a case of, you know, that kind of collective, throwing in Chelsea as well, of winning their games now up until them crucial fixtures. Like you say, they cannot afford to drop any more points until they come into them big games against City now.
No, absolutely. It's just about keeping, just trying to keep the pressure on. It's like City don't look like they're in any danger of dropping points anytime soon, but when they do, and they will, because like it's law of it's, we've seen this in football over time, that it will happen at some point. It might not be the team you'd expect them to do, but because let's face it, West Brom have probably pushed them as close as anyone of the teams, and the only team we've stopped them scoring is Wolverhampton Wanderers.
Yeah, true.
So it's like it will happen at some point, and you need to be close enough to make it count at the time, because the dangerous thing, and probably what the rest of Europe's going to be keen on as well, the likes of Real Madrid, Barcelona and PSG, because they'll be watching this, because City have looked very dangerous in terms of a Champions League prospect as well. The last thing that Europe's going to want is Guardiola being able to bench De Bruyne, Aguero and Gabriel Jesus on Saturdays before Champions League quarterfinals and semi-finals.
That's true. And Spurs, of course, have got the big one for them the weekend after the international break. Arsenal away at the Emirates Stadium. They go into that game as favourites, you would think, Spurs? Oh,
absolutely. In terms of form, Arsenal, Wenger's done quite a good distraction job of making out some decisions when against Man City.
For me, it was a penalty. I couldn't agree more that the third goal was offside, but I'm sorry, it is a penalty.
Oh, completely.
Yeah. Nacho Monreal has been caught the wrong side, and as soon as you touch Sterling,
well,
you know, any player's going to go down, not just Sterling.
Well, as we've known for 21 years or so of Arsene's reign, that he's got an amazing eyesight when it comes to these kind of decisions, but when his player gets a red card, has gone blind. So, like, it's, I almost wish I did have Arsene's glasses sometimes for these moments, but
well, one a familiar theme in looking at the results this week, Gray. There are a lot of 1-0 wins there. There was the most popular scoreline of the weekend. Huddersfield, Bournemouth, Burnley, Brighton, Spurs and Chelsea all recording 1-0 victories. You look at two of those teams in particular who were on the wrong side of them results. West Brom away at Huddersfield, Swansea at home to Brighton. Now, they're two established Premier League clubs losing to promoted teams. Now, West Brom are without a win in 9 games now. Swansea are second from bottom. I think it's very much the case now that their managers, Tony Pulis and Paul Clement, if they aren't, they should be looking nervously over their shoulders. Not in terms of maybe their job prospects, but their clubs are getting sucked in to that relegation battle.
Oh, no, absolutely. Pulis has been around the block quite a lot of times, so I doubt he's too worried so far, though he'll be concerned with the run of form. And they probably should have seen out the draw with Watford a couple of weeks ago when they led 2-0 and stoppage time and stuff. But the way they naturally play them, particularly games and tight, and sometimes it is a case of who scores first wins the game. And I'm not particularly worried about them at this point just yet.
No, I was going to say the game against Arsenal, which they lost 2-0. I doubt Tony Pulis has ever taken a team to Arsenal and played that well. They were fantastic in that game. I got nothing to show for it.
I think over the long run, I'd probably be more worried about Swansea, as you alluded to there. I think they were very lucky to stay up last season, because the irony of, like, and Marco Silva probably would still be at Hull, he did all the hard work and then managed to lose to Sunderland,
yeah,
which is what kind of relegated them in the end. And so Swansea sort of got the benefit of it. And in hindsight, it might have maybe done them better to go down, because the squad still looks quite... On paper, it's like they've looked like quite a good little forward line going, sort of with Abraham and Wilfred Boney back and Ayew. But it's just not... They're not really getting the service.
No. And, you know, I remember on our transfer window podcast special, two players that we touched on, myself in particular, on Gregor Krychowiak at West Brom and Renato Sanchez at Swansea. Now, Krychowiak has added a quality passing game to that West Brom team without, reaping the results of his play. But Renato Sanchez has made zero impact at Swansea. His foray into English football has been so underwhelming so far that it's becoming very obvious why Bayern didn't play him and were quite keen to offload him in the summer.
Yeah, I think Bayern's point of view were they were quite keen for him to get some game time and some confidence, and it's not really worked out. And I think everyone, well, judging by the fancy football statistics, a lot of people did expect Sanchez to hit the ground flying after what he'd done at Euro 2016. But as I said, that's kind of like, that's always the interesting thing when sort of managers will put a lot of stock in these players coming in, but you presume they're going to adapt. And it does annoy me sometimes when you hear sort of, like I said, the Premier League's put on this pedestal of us. But particularly in midfield, it is much more fast moving. You don't get as much time on the ball as you do in Europe, in some of the other European leagues. It really is. Like, sometimes it's a little bit like schoolboys football, sort of chasing around, scrapping. But City have kind of proven this season that intelligent closing down and pressure on the ball can make the difference. And teams will cotton on to that, and there'll be even more sort of less time on the ball, or sort of less time to... And I think maybe that's part of Sanchez's problem, is sort of just adjusting to the pace of the game a little bit. And the problem is Swansea don't have time for that. Like, because you look at some of the defeats they've had, particularly sort of at home, they're already in trouble. They're in real, real trouble. And we sort of make a lot of Palace being in danger of being cut adrift, but they're also in serious danger of being cut adrift at the moment.
Yeah, massively. They worry me much more than Palace do.
Yeah, because the only other one that really worries me at the moment is Bournemouth, who had a good win at the weekend. Yeah. Sort of like
another 1-0 winning team.
Which, again, sort of like they played a little bit better than the second half at Newcastle. But again, they've just lost a lot of the vibrancy they've had in the first two seasons in the Premier League. And it feels just like a loss of confidence, because when you sort of heard Eddie Howe's quotes earlier in the season, they're like, the thing I like about him, he's very honest. There's no sort of hiding behind things. And he was saying, I'm not really sure what's wrong. Like, you know, I thought we set us up well. And obviously he'd been confident that with Jermaine Defoe coming in, here we go, you know, proven goal scorer, confident Mateo. And who knows, they could kick on for that. They did okay against Chelsea the other week, but hopefully they can kick on from that. But that, from winning against Newcastle, but they're the other ones I'm worried about at the moment.
Okay, well, that's all we've got time for. Thank you very much for joining us, Gray.
Cheers for having us.
You can subscribe to the Extra Time podcast on iTunes. You can also follow us on the website at www.thenational.ae/sport. And be sure to check us out on Twitter at NatSportUAE. Thank you for listening.